Welcome to Embracing the Muse. I'm your host, Sally Jean Fox, the author of Meeting the Muse After Midlife. And I'm on a quest to discover and understand how we can live our richest, most meaningful, and creative lives at any age, and especially as we age. And I'll be interviewing island creatives to discover what they can share with us about the highs and lows, ups and downs, and possibilities of living and sustaining a creative life. I have a real treat today. I have with me Beverly Natus, who goes by B, who was a longtime Vashon resident, now living in Tacoma, but her legacy lives on, both for what she did on Vashon, but also for her commitment to activist art. And today I want to delve into what is activist art, because from everything I've read about B, this is so critical for our times. And she's been at it for over 5 decades. So we're not talking new kid on the block here. We're talking accomplished artist with great art creds, both on an undergraduate, graduate level, university teaching credentials, shows, expositions, grants, you know, the works. She's a professional artist with some very deep commitments. And that's what I want to explore today, because it would be enough just to make great art. I mean, that takes a lot of guts anyway. But to make art that in some way invites us to think about current issues and what we need to support the common good for all of us, that's a whole nother thing. So thank you so much for making time to be with me today from your studio in Tacoma.
Thank you so much, Sally. I'm honored to be interviewed, particularly since my connections to the Vashon community are still there and very heartfelt. It's interesting to be sitting in my studio, because it's a space where I make things that are not very well known. You know, I make a lot of work for myself to process my angst about living in this time in the world, to deal with my grief, to deal with my rage. But I also make work that's about reimagining the future. And what I'm known for is interactive installations, where people get to tell their own stories about the future, about what they're experiencing in this moment in the world. And so that's just a very brief introduction.
Thank you for
I
that.
Await your questions.
Yeah, thank you for that, because that whole idea of doing something interactive that engages people with their own imaginations, their own stories, their own vision of the future is, to me, that just rings. Because sometimes if we see our poster or movie, you know, that tells us how terrible it is, there's a part of me, particularly because the news tells me that every bloody day, that recoils and says, you know, I need some direction here. I need some fertile imagination. I just don't need to see it in my face, because I can see it in my face every, unfortunately, bloody day. So I love that you're engaging people in their own stories, and you're bringing forth something. So it's not just a static thing. It's a living thing.
Yeah.
Thanks. Has that always been your bent when you've been doing your activist art?
You know, it started in graduate school, unexpectedly. I made a little drawing that my studio mate saw, and he said, oh, this, everybody needs to see this, because everybody's going to have a story about it. And the drawing was one of my early feminist pieces. It was called The Wrong Day to Wear White Pants. And it was just a drawing of white pants with a red dot in the crotch. And I was embarrassed that he was going to share this wildly. I wasn't comfortable with that, but he did, because that's who he was and is to this day. And I got stories from all over. I mean, it was before the internet, before we had the concept of things going viral. It was viral in its own way because so many women wanted to share how that happened to them and how they dealt with it. It was liberating. And I didn't know that art would catch people in that way. But the next big installation that I did, which was about my nightmares about nuclear war, it was called This Is Not a Test, had a similar impact because people of my generation and older who had grown up with the threat of nuclear war and bomb drills in their elementary schools had nightmares and were terrified about the idea that there were nuclear weapons. It's not talked about as frequently now, but and in the late 70s when I did this project, people really needed to share those hidden feelings with each other. And it was through that work that I discovered Joanne Macy.
I was just about to say, because you have in your bio, you had this list of amazing activists who you have worked with over time. And Joanna Macy was one, because that ability to deal with despair and yet lead people into conversations where they can find their community and find some hope, it was part of Joanna's work.
I mean, I was very fortunate. I went to an artist residency. It was the first one I'd ever been to when I was still living in Brooklyn. And it was up in the Adirondacks. And I had been asked by the new Museum of Contemporary Art in New York City to rebuild This Is Not a Test for an exhibition called The End of the World: Artists' Visions of the Apocalypse. And I was so cynical and despairing at the time. I did not know how I could redo this piece and in a way that would be useful, be of service. And there I was in the wilderness. I hadn't been out of the city for years. All I wanted to do was draw and paint trees. It was the fall in the Adirondacks, and it was so beautiful. And above my bed, the retreat center is called Blue Mountain Center, and it was created by robber baron who had, a kind of coming of consciousness in his later years. And he collected work by socially engaged artists. So in the house, there was a Picasso, there was a George Grosz, there were all these different social realists and critical realists. And above my bed, there was a drawing by George Grosz of a beautiful tree. And I said, if George Grosz can do beautiful trees, and he was drawing the rise of the Nazis in Germany, then I can do trees. But at one point, I realized that the new museum was waiting, and I had to figure out what I was going to do. And I went in the library, just pulling books randomly off the shelves. And as I was pulling one book, another book fell on my head. And it was Joanna Macy's first book, Despair and Personal Power in the Nuclear Age. And I sat on the floor and read it. I wrote to her that day. She wrote back to me the next week, and then I was on a roll.
Oh my gosh.
And I went and worked with two of her proteges in Western Massachusetts and did a workshop, my first despair and empowerment workshop. And then when I went to the museum to install my work, I created a box where people could leave their own nightmares and dreams for the future. And on the day of a blizzard, over 100 people showed up to break open the box, and we did our own little despair and empowerment workshop together in the museum. And then, I guess later that spring, Susie Gablick, who was a very important art writer, she'd written a book called Has Modernism Failed? And she saw the show when she was visiting from London to New York City. And she was completely taken with my work and wrote a wonderful review of it in Art in America. And I didn't know her and didn't know that this review was coming out. A friend of mine who was an art historian called me up and she said, "Go get yourself a copy of Art in America." I said, "Okay." And then I wrote to Susie and I said, "Thank you for writing so insightfully about my work." And she said, "I'm coming back to New York. I want to take you out for lunch." Then the following year, or maybe it was a couple of years after that, I got a job at Cal State Long Beach. And Susie was working as a visiting scholar at UC Santa Barbara. And she called me up and she said, "Your mentor, Joanna Macy, is doing a workshop at the Ojai Foundation. You have to come up here and pick me up, and we're going." And so that was the first time I got to meet her in person in 1987. And then I worked with her almost every year after that while I was in Southern California. And the
Oh my
last time I
gosh.
worked with her was probably 2016. And or maybe 17, she did a workshop outside of San Francisco. And what was fascinating is that she invited me to do part of the workshop. That's how much we had trusted each other at that point. So I had people connect with their ancestors and get gifts from their ancestors during a visualization process. And use that to the gifts they received from their ancestors to conceive of the world that we were going to build in the rubble of this one.
Yeah. Well, you're taking my sense of activist art to a whole other place. Because it's one thing to present something that engages people visually, but there's another thing to add that extra element of actually engaging them interactively and having deepening levels of reflection that get triggered by the art that allow people to go somewhere, and it sounds like that's a piece of what you've been able to do to facilitate, to engage people, to work with the despair, to know how you can face into things that are pretty horrible without leaving people in a place that feels impotent and despairing. You're listening to Embracing the Muse with Sally Jean Fox, and I'm talking today with activist artist Beverly Natus.
Yeah, it's important for me on a daily basis now because, I trained with Thich Nhat Hanh at the same Ojai Foundation 2 years later. And my late husband was an ordained lay monk in the Vietnamese Zen lineage, and he meditated twice a day at least. He was very disciplined in his practice. I was never disciplined until recently. And I had, I would go to retreats and meditate every day, but, and I had a weekly meditation group that met in the Zendo in our backyard. We converted our garage into a Zendo when Bob was confronting cancer. And it was a very important part of my life, but it wasn't something that I saw as a necessity every day. I said, "Oh, my art practice is my meditation." No, it's not the same. We have to really be quiet in order to recalibrate our nervous system. And we need that right now because the chaos is coming in from every corner. And people don't know how to take care of themselves. And they become reactive. And, their brains go to that very primitive place of responding with violence or hate speech. And we can't do that because that's how fascism increases its volume. So it's
It's like it sounds to me like you've added yet another piece to this, to what you carry, which is the what I call neuro self-management, which is not a concept that I had when I was teaching leadership 25 years ago. We didn't even talk that way. But now it feels so vital because people are I don't know what the word for it. It's just, our brains are spinning. We're in a fog. We don't know how to manage the level of stuff coming at us every day. And I took a look at your Substack, and one of your recent posts I really loved, and I'm going to quote it right here because it speaks to this other dimension of your art. And it says, "Some folks don't learn to think critically about the systems we live inside and begin to accumulate demons inside their own nervous systems, telling them that they are not a success or not having a happy life because of some personal flaw. And then they find some ways to numb that pain. Capitalism thrives on those internalized demons. The tragedies that I'm witnessing, both in my personal life and within our collective, have given me pause to think more deeply about the human condition and whether we have the capacity to evolve and transform." Well, there were so many good things. I could continue to quote, but just that idea that we carry internalized demons that get translated into a concept of personal flaws. And then we get angry and we lash out and we don't know what to do about it, or we go numb. All these ways that we have for compensating for the agitation that we don't know how to hold, that is really not even ours personally. It has a personal dimension, but it's, and I don't even know how to talk about that. So I was glad you tried,
No, it's crucial to talk about it because it's something that a lot of people carry shame about not being perfect and not doing things right. And I think that comes from white supremacy. It comes from colonial settler mindset that we're better, we're going to show them that we are better, that we're more civilized or something like that. The truth is we need to own. I guess it's Kazu Haga who's written a new book called Fierce Vulnerability. I haven't read it yet, but I'm signed up to take a program with him starting in March to learn more about it. There's a way that we can present to each other the places that we don't understand about ourselves so that we can get more consciousness that this is a shared vulnerability. And that through sharing those vulnerabilities, we develop solidarity, we develop self-esteem, we develop access to our imaginations that get shut down when we're living in shame. And I have to think, in some ways, it's very important to mention my son, because I have a son who's 30. Who struggles with a mental health. He was late diagnosed on the autism spectrum. As a teenager, he was diagnosed with OCD and he was self-medicating with marijuana, which he discovered behind the Vashon Library. He had a whole crew of people that he smoked with. And it worked for a while. It made him feel neurotypical. He didn't know that he was autistic until he was 21, but it made him feel, quote unquote, normal. And the problem is that when marijuana became a commercial venture and they started strengthening the THC, if you go to any psych ward, you will find abundant numbers of teenagers and young adults who have psychosis from the level of THC that is now in marijuana.
No idea.
And so he's a very brilliant young man, very kind, very honest, very thoughtful, and is struggling so much to figure out how to be in the world. And I see him as representative of a whole bunch of young people who are struggling right now. I haven't written an essay about his struggles yet for my Substack, but I told him a year ago that if I do, I'm going to let him read it first.
Of course, yeah.
Because I think it's important for people to know that the people who are very sensitive right now, who really pick up all the things that are wrong, all the cognitive dissonance. They can't cope with it. And so they numb themselves out. They think it's a personal problem. They don't recognize this is happening to everyone.
Yeah, and the ones that who are sensitive, and we need the sensitives because they're often the poets, the artists, the ones who can see into the future, but they can't tolerate the weight of
What we,
anxiety and
yeah,
confusion
they
and
can't.
catastrophic thinking and all. And I know I'm not like your son, but I have that sensitivity that where I just have to say, "Ooh, I can't hold any more right now." You know, I need to pull back a little or not read as much or take care at all. So that was another question that I had because, and this will probably be saying more about me than anything, but sometimes if you say social activist art, for some of us, we jump to that place, oh, I'm not doing enough. I'm not doing enough. You know, I should be doing more for the world. And who of us can say that we're doing enough? You know, there's no enough when you look at what the world is today, but being able to handle staying engaged and yet having those voices to say, this hurts so bad. Am I doing enough? But I don't even know what enough is. Does that make sense? Because I think, oh.
You're making me think of a story I heard from Pete Seeger many years ago, the folk singer.
Yes.
He used to say, everybody carries a teaspoon to put in the bucket. That's all you need is your teaspoon. And everybody's going to do it differently. I mean, I used to get into trouble at universities when I taught because I would say I'm teaching art for social change and healing. And they would be like, well, are you proselytizing? And I'd say, I am not proselytizing. I am asking the students to tell their own stories. That's political, to have students tell their own stories. And
You
that's
bet.
where social change comes from.
Yeah.
It's and that's their teaspoon into the bucket for social change, is telling your story. And everybody's going to tell it in a different way. And some people may not want to tell their story. They may want to tell what they've witnessed. They may want to just go out there and feed people. There's so many different ways that people feel called. And I think it gets complicated if you're around self-righteous activists who think they have it all figured out, and that can be very alienating, especially if they speak in large words that you don't understand. So I think if
Yeah,
you,
and have a trace of superiority or misogyny sprinkled in or
yes, and that
whatever
can
else it might
happen.
be, you
Yeah,
know.
that can alienate people. But
Yeah.
you know, the truth is, I mean, I've led so many workshops now, and I had an installation that I did in England a couple of years ago. It's called We Almost Didn't Make It. And it was a project where people had to walk through trauma curtains in order to participate. And there was a behind the curtains, there was something I called the portal of possibilities. And it was surrounded with doormats. Each doormat had text on it, and it said things like, overwhelmed, I can't take any more, we might as well go extinct. And I invited people to make an object that represented something that might not be here in 150 years. And it could be a metaphorical thing. I had all this junk on a table that they could weave together or glue together, staple together to represent this thing that might not be here in 150 years. And then insert within that artifact a commitment to an action that might help support descendants, might help them not just survive, but thrive. And so people brainstormed together what they were going to put in their artifact. And people were like, is it enough to grow food for my neighbors? Is it enough to tell stories to children? I said, all of that is activist. There's none of that should be thrown out. You know, you can do an inventory in your neighborhood and find out that there's all these skills here, people who know how to organize things, people who know how to create a budget, people who know how to sing and direct people in a group sing, a group chorus. There's so many different skills that you can harvest and create a community art project in your own neighborhood. And all of it is activist. But people don't see it that way. But the activism comes from you're speaking to your neighbors.
Yeah, this is so potent. And makes me think that we don't have a fully developed idea about how we as a collective need each other to move forward, because we're in a society where it's, the individual matters. And you follow your dream and you do your hero's journey and you create your success. But in that model of you doing the best that you can or as much as you can or success, it's hard to acknowledge that your part is so little. And it can feel kind of hopeless until you see all the other little parts playing together. And that's not the typical lens that we have. I think we're more tuned in to the heroic individual who's saving the world, or
Yeah, that's a paradigm that is in the process of being composted, I think.
it's being composted, or at least it's leaving its deadly carcass around to be seen. I don't know whether I would credit it with composting yet, but yeah, no, I think it is. And I it came up for me because a friend of mine who was a civil rights lawyer is helping to support two young teenage immigrants with their legal bills. So she's done a fundraiser and I contributed to the fundraiser. And I thought, holy crow, it costs so much money to help two young women get decent legal help. And okay, so this is my part. But then you think, but there are millions, out there. And then you feel, so it's kind of like, yes, ah, at the same time, you have to hold both the possibility and the pain that
Yes, you
you, there's
do.
only so much you can do as an individual, at least.
That's why a spiritual practice is important, and the spiritual practice could be forest bathing. I was raised by a scientist who was basically a fundamentalist scientist. It wasn't, the material world was all that mattered, and he was also into organizing for social justice, but that was not his spiritual practice. That was, and he grew food in the backyard with my mom, and I would tease them and say that they were praying when they knelt down on the ground and planted seeds. And they would say, "Oh, you're just full of nonsense." They couldn't stand it if I even said I had an intuition. They were totally opposite from me. But I never told them that I talk to trees and trees talk to me, because they would have sent me to a psychiatrist, I'm sure. But anyway, it was I think it's crucial to have a way to balance the suffering that you witness so it doesn't drag you down into the muck with gratitude every day. Grief and gratitude is, I have a project that I did, when was it? In 2014, I made portable altars for grief and gratitude. And people could write things underneath each altar. And, they were for clean air and for honeybees and for, old growth trees. Each altar represented something and that I was grieving about. And then I was also feeling gratitude for them. I had an altar for indigenous peoples. And, I think every day it's kind of a dance that we have to do between, okay, I'm going to look, as you said before, I'm going to look at this much and then I have to take a break. because I know I can't handle more. When we lived on Vashon, I had a lot of art by my peers, activist art on the walls, and some of it was very disturbing. And my son asked me to take it down when he was maybe 10 years old. He said, "I can't look at this stuff." And I respected that, because I had more tolerance for it. But I was also, this is another story about my son that I think is important to tell. When I lived in California, I developed a disabling environmental illness. And I had to leave a tenured position at Cal State Long Beach because they were spraying pesticides from helicopters. That, on top of the smog, was too much for my body. I already had a load of pesticides in my body because my father was a chemist and he used chemical pesticides in the backyard. And as a child, I'd run around while he was spraying and I'd pick berries off the bushes. So I already had malathion and DDT and chlordane and dioxin in my body when I experienced the air in LA. And when my son was 6 weeks old, we moved to Western Massachusetts to a rural village so I could recover. And it took many years for me to get well because I was sleep deprived. I was nursing all the time. I wasn't able to eat many foods. I was very skinny then. And I was painting one day on my computer because I couldn't use art supplies at the time. I was allergic to everything. And so Sam was watching me paint on the computer and he said, "Why are you always painting sick people?" And I was meeting a lot of sick people in the clinics that I went to. And I said, "Oh, I'm only looking at what's wrong." A light bulb went off in my head. And I was like, "I think it's time for me to paint the healing." So I started painting healing Buddhas and Bodhisattvas. And I did a whole series that I called Healing Deities. It was really difficult for me to do. I didn't, it felt goofy. I felt like I was being a new age woo-woo something or other, but I started to get well. So I credit my 4-year-old son with helping me recognize that I was spending too much time looking at the shadow. I was spending too much time looking at what's wrong. And I needed to pull myself out of that hole. I've also been doing work with a friend who is a quantum energy healer. He's a very old friend. I've known him over 50 years. And he does this work remotely. And a few years ago, he helped me understand what catastrophic thinking was. I didn't know that that was my pattern. I'd read the news and I'd say, "Well, it's all over. We're doomed." And it's so easy to do that right now. That's what fascism wants us to do. We'll just crawl into a closet and not do anything. The goal of my spiritual practice now is when I see my brain leaning in that direction, I say, "Okay, let's not spiritually bypass. There are terrible things going on. But what can I do that is uplifting in this moment? What will be helpful?" And it won't be helpful for me to be in the closet.
You're listening to Embracing the Muse with Sally Jean Fox, and I'm talking today with activist artist Beverly Natus. Behind you, there's a lot of art. I wish people could see it, but we are audio only. So do you make art just to be creating something with your own hands and enjoying that process sometimes without having to have it mean anything or go someplace?
I will go for long periods without making anything. And because since I left the university 5 years ago, it's almost 6 years ago now, I haven't been invited to be in shows very frequently. And so my goal is to finish my fractured memoir. So I've spent a lot of time rewriting and writing and rewriting and writing again. And I'm also writing a lot for Substack, at least 2 essays a month. I love writing. It's a very easy practice for me, in some ways, because I wake up in the morning with sentences just kind of bubbling out of my head. But I miss making things with color and texture and shape. And so what I've done in the past year is I use a lot of text in my work. So I'll have phrases like nature will persist, and then I'll make colors and shapes around it, as a way to kind of trick myself into making images again. If I had a deadline, I'd be in here all the time. But without someone saying, "Oh, I want this body of work," I tried for my husband's sake. He really wanted me to have a retrospective. And before he died, I had an open studio as part of the Tacoma Studio Tour. And so I put up basically a retrospective of flat work. And collage and digital photography and paintings and drawings on the walls. And it was overwhelming. It still is a bit overwhelming to come into my studio because it's 50 years, spanning 50 years of work in here. But I've really, really enjoyed having the intimacy of the space, and Bob was able to see my retrospective before he died. It was very difficult for him to climb the stairs, but he came. He had 2 courses of chemo for his aggressive melanoma. And it wasn't diagnosed at first because it was pandemic when he got this sore on the top of his head. He thought it was from hitting his head multiple times. But when it was finally diagnosed, it had already gone to his lymph nodes.
Ouch.
And it's called BRAF, melanoma, and it's the most aggressive melanoma you can get.
Ouch.
And he did a lot for Vashon. He had an organization called SEEDS, Social Ecology Education Demonstration School, and they did soil remediation demonstrations with mushrooms and plants. He organized a town hall. I've forgotten the name of it now, but it was a place where people could dream what Vashon could be in the future. He also organized the Vashon Green Map.
Oh, I
And
remember that. All of these are
yeah.
great.
And
Was
that
his,
came.
did you guys share the same last name,
No, his
Natus?
last name was Spivey,
Oh,
Bob
okay.
Spivey.
Bob
And
Spivey.
he, one of his Buddhist names in Tibetan was the one who opens the door for others. He never got credit for a lot of the things that he did, and he didn't care. He just did it. And he, I think was very much a Vashon person. If I hadn't wanted, well, if Sam hadn't needed to move off island to get the care that he needed for high school, and then I didn't want to move back to Vashon because I felt I needed to be in a spectrum of color, and Tacoma offered that. So, but he loved where we lived on the island. He felt like he was walking through a cathedral every time he walked through the forests.
And he
Yeah,
was,
he was. Yeah.
Let me ask you one thing. Are you in your 70s now? I'm taking a guess.
I'm 72. Yeah.
72. Yeah. Obviously you're skilled in your profession, you're skilled in art, you're skilled in social change, you're skilled in facilitation. So climbing those particular mountains may not ha hold any attraction, but what is your North Star for the next 15 years for your engagement with either art, with activism? Because like you said, it may not be a show, it may not be proving yourself to anybody, but what pulls you forward?
There are two things right now. One is that I'm mentoring younger people through the Institute for Social Ecology, where I mentioned earlier Bill Moyer and Bob and I were involved with the Institute. They don't exist as a literal space now, they're a virtual space. And I started working with them in the fall. They wanted me to work earlier, but I was still grieving and didn't have capacity for it. And I'm being interviewed right now, so hi. So I ended up being a mentor in their program in when was it? Yeah, the fall. And now they really like me, and the mentees like me, so I'm going to continue. Through the Seattle Public Library, I was also mentoring people. I ran a program called The Art as Medicine for Catastrophic and Transformative Times. And one of the people who was in that program is now planning to work with me on a regular basis. And we're going to do an exchange. She's going to help me organize my studio in exchange for getting help in how to do her own community art projects. And I want to help people facilitate community art. I think a lot of people think it's overwhelming to figure out how to do that. And because Bob and I were able to create the Tacoma Story Hive with no funding, just with the energy and skills of our neighbors, I think that that's a really positive way to help people navigate this time in the world, that you can do this with your neighbors. You can create your own story hive in the neighborhood. And the rest is just writing, I think. And I'm also training as an improv actor. And I'm in the third level starting on Wednesday. I'll take the third level course. I
A
love it.
Tacoma troupe, or yeah.
Yeah, it's a Tacoma troupe.
Sweet.
And I used to do improv in college and high school. And so it's just, and Bob and I used to run workshops for the Theater of the Oppressed. So,
Yeah.
I dance every Sunday. So what I feel is I'm able to live out all the dreams I had in high school to express myself through every art form. I'm not singing at the moment, but my housemaid is getting me engaged in that. She wants me to sing again. And
Sweet.
we've done some karaoke, so that's a
Look
beginning.
out, world. Yeah. And you worked once upon a time with Laurie Anderson, the performance artist.
Yes,
How did that happen?
I was in graduate school. She was not yet the superstar, and she came into my studio and she saw all these words on my wall, big text pieces, and she said, "Have you ever recorded?" And I said, "When I was a 6 and 7 year old, I had a used dictation machine, and I used to speak into the mic and tell stories that no one ever heard, but I loved it." And so she said, "We're going in the sound room." So she had me back in the days when it was a four-track sound room, she had me record text, and that was the audio for "This Is Not a Test."
Wow.
So,
That's a moment. That's a
yeah,
moment.
it was a moment.
I know in 2009 you published a book called Arts for Change, Teaching Outside the Frame, which I haven't seen it, but it sounds fascinating. But so does the topic that you were offering the Seattle Public Library, which I want to say it again. It was so rich. Art as medicine. Do you want to?
For art as medicine for catastrophic and transformative times.
It feels to me that there's a real hunger out there for what you're talking about and what you're exploring. Will you be writing more about that, or is that will that be coming through your Substack, or what's your thinking
Yeah,
there?
it'll come through my Substack, and as I have capacity, I'll begin to offer more of it online for people. I have to keep it in balance.
Of course, we do that, but I just there's such a hunger.
There
There's
is.
such a hunger for people who can offer medicine, and I love that artist medicine, to both address our soul but also to shift the needle a little bit out in the world at the same time, but being cognizant of them both. And you've been doing this for so many years. You have so much to share. So I'm going to put a reference to your Substack in the show notes for this episode because I want to follow you.
Thank you,
Yeah.
Sally. I appreciate that. Arts for Change was published, as you said, in 2009, and I did my first reading at the Vashon Bookstore. And I had never done a reading of a book before, and I was like, "What am I supposed to do here? Am I supposed to read the book?"
Yeah.
And the place was packed, and I was like, I was stunned by it. But the book is mostly. It's not just my story. It's a story about all the courses that I created for UW Tacoma, which was a very unique curriculum. Instead of your typical studio art, like figure drawing and printmaking and whatnot, I was teaching body image and art, eco art, the artist is visionary and dreamer, a labor globalization and art, cultural identity and art. And in each class, the student would tell their own story about that topic, and they'd look at the art of other people about that topic, and they would do some kind of collaborative project in 10 weeks. And I felt, and my colleagues who knew about what I was doing, they said, "This needs to be a book." I'd never imagined writing a book, and it was terrifying, just like the first reading at the Vashon Bookshop was. But it was, I had to think about what do I like to write? And I love to write letters. So as long as I was imagining the reader, I was able to write the book. And then I invited about, I think it was about 35 other artists I knew who were teaching art in a socially engaged way to contribute to the book. And so it's not just my story, it's their stories as well. And I thought the process I had with that book when I was teaching full time and co-parenting, it took 9 months to write that book. And it was maybe a bad first trial with writing because my current book has now taken 5 years. And then I
Yeah.
have to give myself grace because it was pandemic, Bob's cancer, his death, his grief, my son's suicidality. It was all these things that were completely normal to interrupt a creative practice. And every day when I wake up, I write after I do my meditation. And so that's what I'm going to continue doing.
Well, I can't wait to read more because what I'm also hearing on the outside is we can write stuff, we can offer, we can do the letters and the descriptions of things that are happening, but there's a certain kind of writing that asks us to be more. And it wasn't like those things were tangents. They were actually shaping you. And now you get to digest it and write it and offer something to the world. So I could talk for another hour, but I should wrap right now so that we don't go too long. But thank you so much. Thank you so much for your time today.
Oh, thank you, Sally. It was a real pleasure.
Thanks so much for listening. I look forward to being back soon and bringing you another conversation with an island creative who can show you how it's possible to embrace your muse and live your richest and most creative life. Till then, thanks for joining us, and thanks to Voice of Vashon, 101.9 FM, for hosting this show. I'm your host, Sally Fox, and I look forward to being with you soon.